Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, welcome back to our monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey and their joys and their struggles with finances and even outside of finances. And you guys, this show, it's not always about actionable content. It is, however, a chance for you to see behind the curtains, to walk in another person's shoes, to experience their lives. Now, our next guest was kind enough to allow me to guest post on her blog, which will be coming out here, and now she is generous enough to share with us her journey and her wisdom. She is currently a radiology resident known as the Debt-Free Doctor and Dr. Wise Money. She is currently a first-year resident in the Department of Medical Imaging at Banner University Medical Center. She firmly believes that financial freedom helps you get better and better and gets happier doctors. Hence, she created her blog, Dr. Wise Money. That's DR. DR Wise Money. And as she achieves her own goals of like purchasing a house and paying off her student loans, refinancing her house, maxing out retirement savings, she's writing about, she's giving talks on personal finance for physicians, assisting her colleagues to achieve financial success. She has been featured on websites like the White Coat Investor and Non-Clinical Doctors, and I just can't wait to hear about this journey. Please help me welcome Dr. Amanda Liu. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Amanda, it's my pleasure. So first, tell us a little bit about you. You mentioned before we started here that you didn't grow up here in the U.S., so tell us about your childhood.
I grew up in Taiwan. I was there until I was 16 years old, and I immigrated to America, was taken under the wing by my very kind and generous extended family, mainly my aunt Mary and Irene.
And where in the U.S. did you end up coming to?
I was in California, Southern California.
Southern California. So that's a bit different than Taiwan, I would say.
Oh, it was a huge cultural shock. It's very, very different. It was a pretty big transition for sure.
Tell us about that. What were some of the shocks and the changes? Here you were a teenager, 16 years old, moving to the U.S.
I think some of the I'll highlight one of the major differences, or maybe two. In Taiwan, growing up, we were in a financially pretty tough spot, and I remember there were debt collectors coming to our doors. There weren't a lot of protection for consumers. And as a child, I was very frightened, and I always worried about my father's welfare when he walked out the door, if he's going to get in trouble or get in physical danger because of the debt collectors. And I remember collecting like a few little coins around the house and hoping I can save up that money and pay off the debt, the collectors, and so they'll never bother us again. But
what an experience. As a child, I can't even imagine how scary that was.
Exactly. My mom set me down and she said, Amanda, we can't afford to put that money away. We need those coins for food. So at that moment, I felt pretty powerless. I felt, because the only thing I could think of to help my family was collecting the coins. But then even that was not too helpful. So that was what financial life is like in Taiwan. And when I came here, it's very different. I see the American dream. I see how my aunt went from someone who was an illegal immigrant making, $2 an hour to becoming a multi-business owner. And I see how she's able to help the entire family who follow her footsteps as immigrants into America. So that's one major difference. Yeah. And the other thing is the difference in education. In Taiwan, the education is extremely rigorous, and we're all very dedicated. But at the same time, we are spoon-fed the information. But in America, it seemed like education is like a buffet. Basically, you're at an all-you-can-eat place, and you get to grab and reach for whatever you want. And so it was liberating. It was a pretty interesting transition. There are some downsides when I transitioned, but these, I guess the two major things that I experienced different between Taiwan and here was actually a positive change.
Isn't that something? Now, is I've never been to Taiwan, and maybe many of our listeners hadn't either. I generally think of it as being a pretty developed country, but it sounds like maybe there aren't as many opportunities there, perhaps, huh?
Yes, definitely. What happened is, I think in Taiwan, you get really amazing education in the fundamental sciences, mathematics. I mean, people in eighth grade would be learning stuff that's college level here, AP stuff. So I think that's, in a way, it's wonderful. I really appreciate it. I have solid foundation from what I've learned there. It just, I don't know how to describe it other than the difference between, you know, being given a bowl of food in Taiwan versus coming here and it's a buffet of, you know, you have freedom of choice to choose and pick what your interests are, what topic you want to kind of dive in deeper, stuff like that.
So is it the kind of thing where you have to choose kind of ahead of time where you want to go in Taiwan in terms of you get put into, you're going to study this. This is what you're good at. Am I not characterizing that right?
I think you're right. The branching and the decision point to specialize and to focus on one area of study is earlier on in Taiwan than in America. But in general, like when up to the level of education, which is high school first year for me in Taiwan, the idea is everyone's pushed to the extreme in every single specialty and subject. For instance, I think that one big difference is that medical school, I think, could start at 18 or 19 when you finish high school, whereas here, people usually start at 22 when they finish college.
So then being a teenager, did you always know you wanted to be in medicine when you came over here? Or tell us about that journey of being a physician.
So the funniest thing is I was like any other kid who wanted to do medicine. It's pretty ordinary in that I love sciences and I love people, and I just figured that was the best combo. I could help people and I can continue to study the fascinating science of, you know, especially human body, which I think is an incredibly well-designed and unbeatable, you know, creation. But then my mom, quite, you know, different from your stereotypical Asian mom. And she told me I could be anything I want in life, but a doctor. She told me that if I want to be a pediatrician, she'd rather that I go to be a kindergarten teacher. If I want to be a geriatrician, she wants me to work with old people in some other capacity than being a doctor. And so while I could have been some other Asian mom's dream child who loved to be a doctor, my mom was saying, you can be anything in the world but a doctor.
And why was that? Do you know? What was behind that?
She told me. She actually knew me quite well, and I kind of have to agree with her. She is pretty wise in that. She told me, Amanda, like, you will not survive one day being a doctor because you get too emotionally attached to people and you feel their pain, and you're going to die inside if you go be a doctor. And if you love kids so much, why do you want to see 30 sick kids suffering a day? Why don't you work with 30 healthy kids in a kindergarten classroom?
So despite that, you got here to the U.S., and when you applied to colleges, were you applying as pre-med, or what was that like?
Yeah, basically, I was just so interested in the biological, chemical sciences, just how things work, especially how things work inside a living organism, that, you know, I was definitely going for the molecular biology, And getting ready for going to medical school. Yeah, I guess, you know, I thought I wanted to be a doctor, so I just kind of walked the step and just kind of did it one step at a time. Yeah.
Well, and isn't that something? Well, I got to imagine, for many physicians, which I know this is a subject you're passionate about and I'm passionate about, is debt. And here you come from a family that's barely making it, had debt collectors and really hard issues. And then you come here to the U.S. and your aunt sounds like she's been extremely successful. How did debt play a role for you in your undergraduate education? What did you do to address that, or what's been happening there for you?
So, yeah, unfortunately, debt has caused some PTSD in me. I am extremely debt averse. So in college, what happened was I was fortunate enough, I believe, my grandfather actually set aside $30,000 to help with educational fund. And so for college, that was the help I received from family. And I also had seven jobs.
Seven?
Myself. Yeah, at one point it was seven, but otherwise it's like two to three every semester throughout the entire college time. And the reason that I escalated to seven jobs was because my parents got into debt trouble in America. My father fell behind on his credit card payments, and his interest rate went up to 30%, and I really panicked. So I went from a honor roll 4.0 GPA student at UC Berkeley to someone who basically really did very poorly because I was working seven odd jobs trying to send home some money to pay the bills.
Wow.
So debt really has eaten away at me for quite a while since childhood. But today, you know, I have a very bright story to tell. Like, I feel so fortunate because, I guess, of this deep-seated fear for debt back then. I am debt-free now. I can't believe that while some of my unfortunate peers have $300,000 of student debt at 7% interest rate, I've paid off all of my student debt, and I feel so grateful, and I feel free.
That is amazing. So how did you do that? During college you were trying to pay your way. You got some money from your grandfather, which helped out, but certainly that didn't pay the whole bill of going to college. And obviously going to medical school, I'm guessing you're paying anywhere from $40,000 to $50,000 a year for 4 years probably, right?
Yeah.
So, how'd you do it?
Well, so it's a combination. It's a combination of working. So I did have two jobs in medical school, which averages out to be about 40 hours a week. However, there are lots of opportunities to work in medical school while you actually get to study or do research or do things you would have been doing anyways. So if people look into work-study program, they can be paid really quite well, $15 an hour, not minimum wage. And, for instance, one of my jobs was working at the library, and where I will actually hold little study session and help my classmates study, help myself learn while I get paid on the clock at $15 an hour. While it doesn't seem like $15 an hour is a lot, it actually helps foot some bills, and what's more important is that it gives you a cash flow to pay for things instead of being living on a borrowed dollar that starts with 4% origination fee plus 7% interest on day one. So,
right.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, living on borrowed money in medical school is a very scary thing. But none of us had any education or informational session about how to manage our debt from day one. Prevention is the best medicine, but none of us were taught that. And so that's why I'm trying really hard with my blog to reach people and say, hey, if you're a first-year med student, if you know, no matter what stage you're in, you could deal with your debt, although most ideally you deal with debt by preventing it. And so having a job helped. They charge my parents 30% when they're hardworking, diligent people who just merely missed one payment. I turned the whole table around, and I used them to carry my student loan debt, and I saved $60,000 of interest alone in medical school. So if you needed a little detail, what I did was simply every 4 months I would need to pay about $15,000 to, you know, $18,000 in student tuition alone. And so instead of taking the student loan out, which is so easy, it's like Monopoly money. You send a one-liner to your financial aid advisor and say, I need such and such a month. And guess what? Within 30 days, that check will arrive, and you will be able to deposit it and use it like Monopoly money. But so instead of doing that and allowing myself to, allowing the time value of money to work against me starting day one of medical school at 7%, I just went ahead and charged a credit card that $15,000 of tuition. So what happened is that credit card is 18 months 0% interest free on purchases. So that buys me a year and a half of 0% interest as opposed to 7% interest, and there was no origination fee.
So interesting. That's incredibly smart. Well done, Amanda. That's amazing. And even being a medical student, you were still able to find credit card companies that would give you that up to that limit.
Yes, because I firmly believe, I mean, okay, so I didn't have much income, because if you looked at like the $15 an hour I made, it doesn't add up a whole lot to getting a large credit limit. But what happened is I build up my credit gradually thanks to how much I had to spend as a medical student. Basically, the way I see it is credit score or credit limit or credit history, all of this credibility issue in consumerism, it's all about just like going to the gym. If you don't stretch or work your muscle, it's not going to grow. So The reason that I keep getting more and more offers and banks start competing for my debt is because they saw that I was a big spender.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like most members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you have never received financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. And maybe you even made a few mistakes along the way. And that's exactly why I wrote my book, 10 Critical Mistakes Doctors Make with Their Money, and the brand new ebook, 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes. As a matter of fact, you can't buy 5 Steps to Overcome. But you can get the entire ebook for free by subscribing to my free email newsletter at www.drfreedompodcast.com. My email newsletter lets you know once or twice a month whenever I posted fresh content to my podcast, so you don't always have to visit my podcast website. Plus, my newsletter subscribers, they get a first crack at exclusive offers and lots of free stuff. You can get the whole copy of 10 Critical Mistakes and your free copy of 5 Steps to Overcome Common Physician Financial Mistakes ebook by visiting drfreedompodcast.com and enter the form on the page.
They think we're going to make a buttload in 18 months, right?
Yes, and then because Discover wants that, and they gave me 18 months, and then Bank of America wants it, they gave me another 18 months, and then Citibank wants that, gave me another 21 months, voila, I'm out of medical school, and I haven't incurred one penny of interest.
So were you able to move from credit card to credit card, or did you end up paying it off every 18 months? You know, what was that like?
Yeah. So basically, my principle was cash is king. I only put cash where it really, really makes a difference in my life, and when I absolutely have to use it. So, yeah, I make little with $15 an hour, 40 hours a week. With that $600 per week cash flow, basically, I only use that towards whatever I can't charge. So in the end, yeah, like today, I'm as a second year PGY2, I am almost 2 years out of medical school. I technically completely paid off my student loans last year, and I carry no debt, even, you know, credit card debt for to that speak of my student loan anymore. But throughout med school, I wouldn't have the money to truly pay the debt off. So like you said, it's pretty much rotating with the lowest interest possible, and occasionally taking out student loans to pay off a balance that I couldn't rotate.
But that was relatively smaller amount because you were getting paid to study. I love that idea. That's awesome. Let's switch gears here a little bit and the time we have remaining. Now, I know we talked about an introduction, and I think you blogged about it on your site, that one of your financial goals has been to purchase a house. So I'd like you to tell us about your thoughts behind buying a home while you're a resident.
Okay. So I know a lot of people have this like buy versus rent idea, and if it's not 5 years, possibly not worth it to buy. And a lot of people talk against buying a home. But for me, the thought was because when I apply for residency, I really had this long shot view of how to line up my internship, residency, and fellowship all 6 years in one location. Even though it's a lot more work coordinating all their interviews that way and making sure things line up at the front end, it really pays off in the long run in that I don't have to move three times after med school. So as soon as I knew my where I matched and that, you know, I have accomplished my goal of lining up all 6 years of training in the same location, I went ahead and think it was a good idea to buy, even for the most conservative people who say, you know, buy versus rent, at least 5 years make buy a better choice. And the other way I look at it is that if I'm going to have to live somewhere, if I'm going to pay rent that's $1,300 a month, I might as well pay mortgage that's $925. I know I, you know, have to pay the additional HOA and all this other cost that could put will bring it up to $1,200. But I like the idea of saving $400 of equity every month.
Sure. It's a tough call, I think. Maybe we could talk back and forth about this a little bit, because the question is, do you, at the end of your fellowship or residency, whatever that looks like, is this the place that you want to continue to live in? And if not, which you don't know for sure until you transition to practice, perhaps, depending on what your specialty is. As a radiologist, maybe it's a little more in demand, I'm not sure, but let's say you decide that you are going to move elsewhere. They need to have to decide, do you sell or do you rent, and grapple with that decision. So where are you at in terms of thinking about 5-6 years from now when you are in practice? Is this the place that you want to live for sure, that you're going to find a job, or what would that look like for you?
As I kind of work in my program, you know, it's been almost a year in my radiology program, I see a very high chance of staying and getting a job locally, and I'm really in love with the town of Tucson. It's just a gorgeous place, family-friendly, and it just, I really love it. So I see myself here both for professional and personal reasons. However, it is possible that I might move to a different house, but I have the inclination to keep this house for my parents since they don't own a house. And if they are not interested in living here, they want some go to somewhere else, then I'll rent this house out, because I'm not the type of person who likes a lot of transaction, because every time there's transaction, I believe the businessman, the middleman, profit, and not me. So I like to keep this house, and either as a landlord or give it to my parents as a gift, or just live in it myself.
Well, and if it's debt-free by the time that you do that, which it sounds like you'd probably be on track to at least working towards that or being close to that, then cash flow may not be a problem for you.
Yeah, I believe so, because I basically did the calculation. I probably will pay off this house, if I would like to, within 4 months of finishing residency.
Nice. Well, and I did mention in the intro that you blog about this stuff on Dr. Wise Money. That's drwisemoney.com. So tell us about, how did that come about?
It came about when I tasted what it was like to not have a debt at 7% growing and snowballing on my back. And I just couldn't keep that good feeling to myself. I want my peers, I want my dedicated colleagues who dig their nose into the books to help other people and who are so idealistic about caring for patients and giving as their whole profession. I want them to be taken care of too. So I wrote one post and I sent it to my mentor who has a very successful blog. He's a WICO investor, and he said, "Yeah, make this I'll make this a guest post." And I said, "You know, I should start on my own blog too. I should keep writing about this, and I want to see my friends, you know, get out of debt as soon as possible, and I want them to feel free to do what they love to do rather than, you know, waking up every morning just working for debt or working for,
I totally hear your heart on that. I feel so much the same.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, in one of your blog posts that you sent to me ahead of this call, I thought was really interesting that I recommend everyone check out because there's a ton of meat in here. And the blog post was titled, "How I Can Retire at 38. Wow, that's amazing. So if you don't mind, just real quick, tell us about that blog post, and people can definitely check it out online. But you've got to tell us, how could you retire at 38? That's just a few years out of fellowship.
Yeah, that is, it's about 2.8 years out of fellowship, and it would be, let's think, it would be about less than 9 years out of medical school, and that's usually the time when people are still 60 to 80% in debt with their educational costs from medical school. So I definitely feel very fortunate, and the reason that I could do it, it's really very simplified. Is that one? I don't spend a lot of money, and because I realize like most of my happiness come from free stuff. That's one. Number two is that because of that, you know, I really feel very comfortable saving 60% of my income right now, and as I project it further down, as I become an attending, I feel really comfortable saving 86% of my income as an attending. So when you can save that much, because you don't have that much desire to, you're not high maintenance, number one. Number two, you can put away that much, and you can put that amount of money to work for you day and night when you sleep, or, you know, whereas, and it can come as a passive income, then early retirement really isn't a myth. Anyone can do it. And as I said in that post, you know, I can retire when I'm 38, but I won't because I love my job.
Wow. Well, that is just a fantastic story and a fantastic post, and one that I think a lot of physicians could really think about in this time where we see so many folks that are struggling with burnout, and they're struggling with wondering if they can make it. And I've talked to a lot of physicians, a lot of clients that they just don't want to keep going at the pace that they are, and they're thinking of going to three-quarters time. But yet when they have all these student loans and a sizable mortgage, unfortunately, they have to keep on the track that they are because, their living expenses don't allow them to, which there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but then you don't have this freedom, to make choices. And we're running out of time here, Amanda, but I'd like for you to finish us out with a couple of different things. Number one, I'd like you to let us know some resources that are awesome that you'd like to point other physicians to.
Okay. I definitely recommend whitecoatinvestor.com. He has a very amazing website. He has all sorts of good information for people, for especially doctors, residents, fellows, to benefit from. He has been a great mentor to me, and he's helped so, countless doctors. Definitely, White Coat Investor.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much we could talk about. And first, let me just say, I'm so proud of you for doing what you're doing. I mean, considering where you started and the hunger you've had, you set yourself up wonderfully. So congratulations on that. Do you have any closing thoughts for other physicians that you'd like to leave with us today?
I think, you know, we all started med school with so much idealism. And we were all overachiever in that we do everything to the best of our ability. And then we went to med school. It's a grueling experience, and the residency is tough. And then on top of that, you know, mental exhaustion, you have this financial news and burden that is so onerous. It's someone else's mortgage on your back that you don't have a house to speak for. And it's at 7%, not a regular 3% mortgage. I think it's so important that, number one, we have to be very truthful with our situation. And number two, we need to be really looking out for each other. We are not here to compete with each other. We need to be rubbing each other's backs because no one else really has our backs covered. I just have to kind of quote a quick anecdotal, like one experience that I had. When I was rotating at UCSF, interventional radiology, it's the world's most renowned place to do interventional radiology. There are 30 people, 30 staff physicians. They are like gods to me. They are so admirable, so smart, intelligent, brilliant, dedicated people. The one thing I observed there was that in between cases, I see the technologists, I see the nurses, PA, everyone taking a nice lunch break, chit-chatting, actually taking a break. But in between cases, I don't see any doctors slowing down to go eat or go use the bathroom or anything, and I see them having 3 minutes stuffing some fries down their throat and just kept working at it from 4 a.m. till 10 p.m. that night, or if a case runs late, then it's 2 a.m. No one went and tapped on their shoulder and say, hey, take a break. So if we as physicians don't advocate for ourselves, don't look out for each other, who is going to do that? So my one last thought is just, I hope all of us are going to look out for each other and share information with each other. And if we have successes, share it so other people can replicate it. If we have failure, share it so other people can avoid it.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you, Amanda, for spending this time with us and investing in physicians and having a heart for other doctors. And if people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you and how can they find your blog?
The best way to contact me is through my blog. It's drdrwisemoney.com. I check the comments. If people have questions, I answer within 24 hours. That's the best way to contact me.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Amanda, it's been a pleasure. And to all of our listeners out there, definitely check out the blog, check out her resources. There's lots of great info for there. And in the future, I'd love to tell your story. It'd be my honor to host you on the next podcast. I know we can learn from your journey, just like Amanda's, with all of the great information she has provided for us, and it will help other doctors. After all, who better to speak to a physician than another physician? So I think there's going to be some awesome stuff, Amanda, drop for us here today. Make sure to contact me, Dave, at daviddeniston.com or on my website, drfreedompodcast.com, with any questions or if you would like to be featured on the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Deniston. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a good one.
Hey, this is Dave Deniston. I hope you liked today's episode. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you did like it and you want some more ideas on achieving financial freedom, visit the podcast website at www.drfreedompodcast.com. That's www.drfreedompodcast.com. And when you subscribe to my newsletter, you'll get a free copy of my ultra-popular ebook, 10 Critical Mistakes Doctors Make With Their Money. Go ahead and check out www.drfreedompodcast.com. freedompodcast.com and snag a copy of your ebook now.